So, the title of the talk is, Please Don't Disturb Happiness. These are difficult times, and we can feel outside the world is struggling. That's not new. Generally, times are difficult. And I guess they have been since the beginning of human history. And but especially now, perhaps we can feel fear and stress and sometimes get caught in despair when we look around at what's happening outside. And these experiences are very strong. They touch us deeply. We easily get consumed or caught in feelings like despair and confusion. For example, when we see violence and extremism and anger so widespread around in the society. And it's very strong for us. And sometimes we can even feel that all the meditation I did kind of disappears into nothing because there's so much emotion coming up when faced with these difficulties. I think we just simply need to understand more deeply about who we are and why is it that those kind of experiences become so strong for us and in a way very easily steal our joy. There's something basic to the self, the me in here, that tends all the time to be more interested in what's missing, in what isn't there, in what I need, in what needs to be fixed, and in what might happen, than in the joy of the moment. There's something quite basic to the self that is all the time looking to see what the problem might be. And of course finding very easily the problem. The scientists have shown that the background state of the brain is constant mild anxiety. So we're all looking in the future thinking, what might happen and how can I prevent it? How can I get it better? How can I avoid problems? How can I avoid disasters? How can I know things and control things so that they'll be less uncomfortable and difficult? That's the self is busy with that. And what that means is the difficulties take more space in the consciousness than the joys. They tend to take more space. And the places in us of harmony, sviat ratzon, of contentment, almost look boring because they don't take a lot of space and we jump over them quite quickly while looking for the next problem. And we don't notice them so much. And because of that, we actually work quite hard to try and find pleasure and find comfort because the discomfort tends to take up so much space in the consciousness and the self is so busy with it. So one of the strategies of the self is to keep looking for comfort, to keep looking for pleasure, to keep trying to get things better. And it's quite a disaster for the whole planet. The planet is burning up because people can't stop running around in their cars and aeroplanes and putting on air conditioning and trying to get more comfortable and use up more and use more energy to try and make things better. And it's very much the endless myth of the Buddha's palace. Because the Buddha was exactly in that place as a prince who was very busy, his palace and his whole community, trying to make the life as pleasurable as possible and designing the whole life in the palace to protect the Buddha from all difficulty and make just pleasure. And the Buddha realized that this is an utter illusion. This is crazy. Because you just can't live without the truth of the pain of life and the joy and the relationship between the two. And so he experienced, he was touched by pain, and the pain were what are called the divine messengers. The pain that he saw, the dukkha, the pain of life that he saw, were his messengers to tell him to wake up. A sick man, a poor man, a dead body, these were the messengers. And so, we need to kind of look more carefully at the whole relationship between dukkha and sukha. Dukkha, pain, sukha, happiness. What is the relationship? How do they relate to each other? The fundamental journey that we have to go on, as I said before, is to become less dependent on conditions and less busy trying to control conditions so as to be happy. And what we need to do instead is to turn to the mind which knows pain and pleasure, and develop a mind that is freer and allows pain and pleasure to arise freely. A mind that stands back from this busyness trying to stop pain and increase pleasure, trying to control everything, to step back and see things from a place of freedom, knowing it's the mind that experiences pain and pleasure, it's not the world. Therefore, if we want to get things right, and we want to understand this relationship between pain and pleasure, there's only one place we can do it, and only one way to do it, and that is to know the mind that makes that difference. And the mind, with the self pushing it, investing, how the mind is a servant of the self, investing in and busy with avoiding pain and trying to increase pleasure. And the basic understanding of this has a depth to it, which is that at the beginning, nobody thinks it's possible. We think, of course we're unhappy because of conditions out there. It's not my mind. Stop telling me about my mind. I know you Buddhists are busy talking about mind, but leave my mind alone. Just make the world a better place. But so at the beginning, we don't actually see that the problem is, or the issue is, the mind that perceives pleasure and pain. We think it's the world that brings pleasure and pain that needs to be fixed. Slowly, slowly, through wisdom, we understand that the mind, the awareness, is basically open and free. And it then, the servant of the self, looks for pain, looks for pleasure, builds a world, creates a castle like the Buddha's castle. And so what we have to do is let the mind acknowledge pain and acknowledge pleasure. Let the mind see pain and see pleasure just as it is. The free mind seeing reality. And the first noble truth of the Buddha is pain is in the nature of experience. Not in life, but in the experience of life. Every being that is born in a body will experience pain, dukkha, because of the nature of the passing nature of life. Because we're born into a body, whether you're an ant or a human being, and I'm talking to the ants here in this room, as well as the human beings. Life is passing, life is short, we're born into a body, nobody asked us, it just happened, and we struggle to keep it going. Name of the game. Cause of that, dukkha, struggle. All we need to do about pain is to know it, to allow it to be there, to recognize its nature, to know pain. The Buddha said, don't try and fix it, just know it. Of course you can fix it if the Buddha had a doctor. But this is natural. But don't be busy all your life trying to get things better, trying to fix things, trying to get more pleasure, trying to avoid pain. Allow pain to be there, allow pleasure to be there. Know what is pain and difficulty, know what is joy and peace. And we may have experienced here already, many of us, that when we actually acknowledge pain, rather than running away from it, or projecting it onto our partners, or our children, or on the Prime Minister, when we acknowledge pain, there's a relief in that. There's a truth in that. It's okay, yes. I can take responsibility for pain. It's okay. It's here, but I'm with it. And when we do that, the pain itself can change, by the way. We can even see certain joy in pain, because it's a truth, and it's life, and it's talking to us, and we can have a relationship with it, whether it's pain in the heart, like sadness, or pain in the body, like a painful back. Our relationship with ourselves creates a dialogue with painful experience which can be rich and can reduce the painfulness of it to us. So when we do that, we begin to realize how much of our life is built around avoiding pain, dealing with pain, manifesting pain and projecting pain into our life, into action. In certain way, every construction, and now we're talking about what you might call deep dharma, every single thought, a movement in the mind has in it as its source some dukkha. Even very, 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 very delicate and subtle. But just the movement of the mind called one thought, construction, is already dukkha. And what is not dukkha is deep peace that doesn't need any construction at all. So it's in the deep, deep spiritual practice of the Dharma, it goes right to that place where even one thought, if you look at it carefully, has in it a sense of form and control and and is packaged. Like the model I like to use is, a thought is the ocean packaged into a bottle. Consciousness put in a box called a thought, based on me and usually what I want. So even on that level, that subtle level, we can notice the arising of dukkha and what it does to us and where we take it and what we do with it. So we realize that much of the needs that we have and the hunger we have and the longing we have for pleasure, for relief, for joy, for peace is driven by dukkha. And that's a really important insight. It's driven by pain and trying to avoid and reduce it. And when we realize that, we can let the whole thing go. Dukkha is to be seen, because when we see dukkha, it doesn't drive us anymore. It's not the engine that drives automatic behaviors and views and feelings that are driven by dukkha and we don't know it. Once we see the power of dukkha, once we see dukkha, we're a partner with difficulty in life and not the slave. And sometimes even joy and I would say positive states of mind, if we look carefully, are driven by dukkha. And we have to be a little careful to look at this. I have a constant dialogue on the issue of positive psychology. I know that positive psychology is very helpful. And it's helpful to cancel the sense of negative psychology, which is the whole kind of 20th century psychology, pathology view. And positive psychology is very helpful. But it has major limitations. And here is really a kind of interesting dialogue that Buddhists are having with positive psychologists, who would likely say, for example, having aims and ambitions in life is very helpful for a positive state of mind. Well, the Buddhists would say having no aims and no ambitions is very helpful for even bigger freedom and bigger joy. So we'd say to the positive psychology, why do you need positive psychology? It's based on pain that you don't want, that you need to replace with positive psychology. I'm just giving this a small example. Even sometimes the most beautiful and ecstatic experiences, spiritual experiences, can be a result of pain and need to be seen like that. Sometimes ecstasy is really because of the pain that was before. That turns into ecstasy when there is this relief from the dukkha and liberation from dukkha, and ecstasy arises. And it's very beautiful, and I really have no problem. It's a beautiful thing when it happens, but we just need the wisdom. I'm thinking here, for example, of Eckhart Tolle, who wrote the book The Power of Now. And what happened to him was he went way, 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 way down into deep depression. And he was at the point of suicide. And he was about to commit suicide one night in a college in England. and he was about to jump out of the window, when a small voice in him said, "Yes, but something in me knows this depression. And what knows the depression cannot be the depression." And that was so strong for him that he kind of collapsed in a heap, and the next day woke up in utter ecstasy as a kind of rebound from the total depression, rebound into it, and he spent the next few years in just ecstasy, wandering like an ecstatic soul through, as he writes, the parks of Europe. And then he became, in a way, a spiritual teacher, coming beyond the pain and the ecstasy into another state of deep spiritual realization. So even ecstasy can be pain-based. So the pain is very powerful. We need to deeply know our vulnerability. And that is where natural joy can rise, like the phoenix coming from the fire. That is the birth of natural joy. Not the place of trying to reduce pain, but the place of allowing our natural vulnerability. And when we do that, we're living in so much more truth and depth that joy comes much more deeply, much more naturally. And again, the story of Yael, who many of us knew, is just that. She met again and again, morning, noon and night, her vulnerability in her journey with cancer. And as she met and stayed with that vulnerability and meditated deeply, she was a deep meditator, and allowed the vulnerability to come, the joy came. And with the sense of vulnerability came the sense of reality, with the truth. Yes, yes, we're vulnerable beings. We're fragile. We're just here for a moment. In this body. Yes. And we can't predict what will happen tomorrow. Yes. And we don't really know. We don't really know what exactly is going on. The world is a mystery, yes. But with all that, there's the truth. So I'm free. And I'm free and dance with the mystery and with the unknown and with the vulnerability. There's nothing left to do except dance in the present moment. Joy arises naturally, and it's the deepest joy. So, I call this default joy. Berat Mechdal. Joy is the default. Suffering is what we learn and is our teacher. But the default in lived beings is actually joy. And having watched many, many babies in the last years, my grandchildren, how there's so much bliss in the moments of their life. And then there's cry. And then there's bliss. When the titsy arrives, bliss. After 2 hours, tears. But the bliss is there, and it's our default nature, if we don't disturb it. And that's why I called it, this title of this talk, Please Don't Disturb Happiness. It's our deepest nature is default joy or happiness, is base. There's a nice story in the suttas of the Buddha walking with his monks in the forest. And all of a sudden, he heard far away kind of hysterical laughter. And he said, "Oh, hear that, listen to that, this hysterical laughter coming from somewhere in the forest. I want to hear what's going on." And one of his monks ran off and said, "I'm going to see who it is." He ran off, and he came back and said, "Do you know, there is a monk, one of your monks, sitting under a tree in the forest, laughing, hysterical, joyfully laughing. So I said, why are you laughing so much? He said, the monk said, I was a king. I had a small kingdom. It was a nightmare. I was constantly worried. I had to have guards standing around my bed because at any minute someone would try and kill me and take my kingdom. I had to have my treasure. I had to count it every day because everyone trying to steal it. I was anxious 24 hours. I couldn't sleep at night. Non-stop anxiety. Now, I abandoned my kingdom. I went to the forest. I sat under a tree. And this is the bottom line. My mind is free, wandering like a deer that is grazing on the grass. And such a beautiful image of joy. My mind like a deer, wandering, grazing on the grass. And there's a lightness of being there. You can't get joy. You can't really design joy. I mean, you can have a happy, pleasurable experience for sure. But you can't design and obtain joy and have it. It doesn't actually belong to us, namely the me in here. Because the me is so full of its agenda of trying to get things better. And therefore, joy escapes like trying to chase the rainbow. So joy cannot be got and owned by the me, by I. It's coming through so much letting go and so much being like the deer grazing, letting go of all the things that interrupt the joy. Like the Indian phrase of an Indian saint that said, I found true happiness when I stopped trying to be happy. True happiness arises as default when we stop interrupting it, including by the desire to be happy. There is a very nice quote from William Blake that I like. He says, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. A life with wings. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So, the last part of this talk, I want to a little bit go into the way joy interacts with other qualities in our practice. And we can see from what I said before that we need to be able to settle into a free mind that is able to look at the arising of pain and joy. So the mind that's free will know default joy. But the mind is training, we need to train the mind to be able to look at. And here is where samadhi, and what we're doing here, is so important. Samadhi, or steadiness of mind, ability to see, and mindfulness, ability to know what's going on, to be the witness of our life, is a fundamental power. And it allows the pleasant and the unpleasant experiences to arise and pass, and not to select one and not the other, and I want the pleasant and not the unpleasant, when we're back in the same system again. Instead of that, the samadhi and the mindfulness allow that free mind to hold pleasure and pain in the palm of our hands. And It brings joy from release. When we know the pleasure and pain, we don't need, dukkha doesn't work on us. And so joy arises. So joy arises naturally from samadhi and mindfulness. But the opposite is also true, that in order to be concentrated and steady in our mind, we also need joy. So, and this is really interesting, many, many times in the suttas, in the text, and probably in our own life, the Buddha would say to people, okay, start your practice with dhamma. Start your practice, you go to the householders, you will go to the villages and say, people say, well, how do I practice for liberation? He said, start by giving, by being generous, by dhamma. Start by living right. When you live right, and you give gifts, and you let go of possessions and hanging on to the world, you will know joy. You will know some joy. Joy will arise. When joy arises, concentration is easier. And one of the factors that you'd think, what's the main power that drives deep concentration and deep meditation? You think, well, it's got to be hard work, and it's got to be really desiring to be deep meditation. It needs many, many hours. It needs a good teacher. It needs, yeah, all those things can help. But one of the main reasons for deep meditation is joy, is having an inner peace, an inner joy and well-being. Then the concentration is deeper. I can share with you a personal story about my own practice, that many years ago I was on a personal retreat in India in a small room the size of this, more or less the size of this platform, and I was there for 6 weeks in a tiny room practicing, and there was a teacher who would come by from a nearby ashram. He would come by, and I very much respected him. So he'd come by every couple of days, and we'd sit together, and he'd talk, we'd talk. And I had the sense at the time that there was a kind of jump that I needed to jump in my own practice. There was a kind of a machson or a tehom. I needed to jump into tehom. And it wasn't happening. I needed to just make a jump into the tehom. It wasn't happening. And one day I told the teacher, he said, oh, what will help you jump is joy. Because what stops you jumping is primal fear. Pachad kiyumi, primal fear. And joy is the opposite of primal fear. So the more joyful you are, the easier to jump. So I said, thank you very much, and soon realized there was no tehom, and there was no jump needed. It was all a construction. but nevertheless, it was a good lesson, and maybe something, you know, that gives you a sense of how joy itself can lead to deeper states of meditation, and how meditation leads to joy. The two are in relationship with each other. The Buddha said, joy is equipment for the journey. Say dala derech. And the final point is, one place that the Buddha called it pamoji in the Pali, which is a deep gladness, a deep sense of joy, yoter gavoa, shall I give, yoter more subtle, but a sense of gladness comes from insights. When we have insight, the insights bring us a sense, a touch of the truth, and we can feel the joy that comes from the Dharma. And it's a very deep joy from coming from a spiritual journey itself. When you see people who are really on the journey a long time and really developed on the journey, they are always cheerful. You just don't really meet miserable Dalai Lamas around. You just don't meet them. And you could say almost that a sign of a sage, a deeply developed person, is basic cheerfulness. It's a sign. It's the cheerfulness of the Dalai Lama. It's the cheerfulness of these great Tibetan sages. It's the cheerfulness of most Dharma teachers I know. They've been through all of this. The mind is free to allow joy, and then the insight comes, and the Dharma arrives, and the Dharma, they live with the Dharma, and it's like living with a deeper truth, and that's bound to bring a deeper joy, pamoji, gladness of mind, which is a mind which is aligned with the deeper truth of Dharma. And I think that's it. Yeah. Thank you.